Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at home renovation and repair, zero in a bit on air quality and radon testing with our two guests, Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison, and John Viner, Senior Project Manager at the Energy Center of Wisconsin. Great to have them back. John, nice to see you again.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. Nice to be here.
And Chad, busy guy now?
Very busy. That's great.
Well, I'm glad you take the time to come.
Yeah, well, thanks for having us.
Really appreciate it. And certainly invite you to join in. If you have a question or comment, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go to my Facebook page. You can post there. You can even post a photo. Maybe you've got a problem with the house that a picture might help us help you describe what's going on. Why, put that on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Let's start by talking about radon a little bit first. John, what's radon and how do you test for it?
Well, there's a couple of ways to test for it, and I just went through a little bit of an exercise over the last several months. I had a couple short-term tests, which last about just a couple of days to a couple of weeks, and it actually came back over the EPA recommendation of about 4 picocuries per liter. So you can go to Wisconsin Department of Health Services and find... they have a series of radon information centers throughout Wisconsin, so that's the place to go online or to give a call for the information center in your area. But short-term kits, like I said, they came over, my results came back about 4 or 5, which is right at the or over the 4 recommendations. So I actually did a long-term test, which was over 3 months worth. You know, after I did some air sealing within my basement, I found certainly cracks in the concrete floor and even an interior wall that was a hollow block wall from an old foundation.
Oh.
So if you have that, sometimes that block wall is open at the top, as was the case in my house. But the good news is it came down to about 2.6 picocuries per liter. So the short-term, long-term tests, and then there's even some monitoring, full-time monitoring, where you get the live display that can be useful.
All right. So at least you're safe now.
I think I'm safe. So those are, you know, each of the tests can be, there's errors built in, and we know that by design. It just happens to get tough to get accurate results. So multiple tests are certainly encouraged for that average number.
Yeah, absolutely. What about air purifiers? Are they important? I know there are people with asthma conditions and so forth can find it useful. Do they add to the house?
Yeah, absolutely. They certainly can, but there is a variety of ways to provide little sanctuaries within the home, so isolating a section or a certain living area is probably a better strategy than a lot of air filters, air cleaners. They may be called ionizers, ozone generators, or HEPA filters attached to the ductwork of your forced air furnace, and they call themselves whole house air cleaners. It is tough to have your whole house be cleaned by those types of products. They do a percentage of the air, and they all either, you know, example, a UV light can provide some pretty good guidance or pretty good effectiveness to mold and bacteria if it's installed correctly on your air conditioning coil, for example, where that mold and bacteria may grow.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe a good strategy in conjunction with that to kill mold and bacteria is to get the small particulates with a HEPA filter, either maybe local in a living room area or a bedroom, for example.
That makes sense. I'm thinking exterior siding. I had some friends who were looking at new exterior siding. And, Chad, are there some new trends in exterior siding? What are we seeing out there now?
Yeah, well, one of the products that's come out in the last 5 years that has become very popular is a product called Smart Siding, which is essentially a similar to OSB, which is a common plywood pressed wood chips and polymers and It's put together in a way that is rot resistant, and it's wood product, so it's very durable. And it ends up pricing out similar to vinyl siding, which has been the low price leader in the siding world for a number of years. And, of course, vinyl has a lot of issues and problems and drawbacks. But smart siding is a very cost-effective alternative. Now, it is a product that you paint. It does have to be, or it can be repainted, which is, of course, a benefit. But it has the look of a real wood siding, and so it's very attractive in that respect. And, of course, there are other products out there. Fiber cement siding has been around for a number of years. It's a little bit harder to work with, and it also is actually a fairly brittle product. I've learned that on my own home. I have fiber cement siding that's 4 years old. And it does not withstand the baseball test, which my son has put it through a few times. So I have some nice dimples on the side of my house that look just like a baseball.
Well, I have fiber cement on our lake home, and I like the look of it. And
it's beautiful. Yeah.
And part of the sales job on that was that it would survive a pretty good hailstorm.
Right. And I do think it will, and we have had my own home and other homes we've done in fiber cement just come out beautifully from hail storms, but a baseball at 60 miles an hour, apparently not.
Oh, man. John Viner and Chad Spade, our guests today. If you have a question for them as we talk home renovation and repair, talk about testing for things like radon and other air quality issues, give us a call. The number, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go to my Facebook page and post at the Larry Mueller Show. We would love to hear from you. Most of us see seasonal fluctuations in our electricity bill. Where does most of the electricity use happen in the average home, and what can we do to lower our consumption, John?
Well, hopefully, if we have a water heater that's electric water heat, then or heated by electricity, that certainly can be a number one load within the house, or any type of electric heat. So if we have those in our homes and basically by choice, or whether we don't have natural gas or we have propane and we've chosen electric for a variety of reasons, that's going to be the number one load. As we go into summertime, obviously we have the air conditioner to think about, and getting that tuned up. And some studies that we've concluded and at the Energy Center of Wisconsin, a wide range of savings can be had by a tune-up with an air conditioning. Some of the big things that have affected the efficiency of the air conditioning has been actually what we found in Wisconsin, that it was too much airflow across the air handler, across the evaporator coil. Often some studies have shown low airflow being a problem in some states, but in Wisconsin, the study really showed that we had excessive airflow, and reducing the airflow across the evaporator coil in our air handler actually showed some pretty good savings. And the other item was low refrigerant charge. So another reason for a tune-up is to make sure that the refrigerant charge is correct, which often is set up right at the onset of the installation, unless we have a leak. So
And then it doesn't get adjusted again for 10 years.
Yeah, if it ever gets adjusted and we live with that air conditioner humming away outside, rattling away, not as effectively as it could. So I don't always recommend a yearly maintenance where we're putting on refrigerant gauges and checking the refrigerant charge, because we lose a little bit of refrigerant every time we do that. But every couple of years or 3-4 years for sure, we want to make sure that that charge is adequate. Right.
Jeff in Beaver Dam has a question for you guys. Hi, Jeff. Thank you for calling.
You're welcome. I've got a 1930s farmhouse with a 6/12 pitch roof, 2x4. I'm not sure the difference between trusses and rafters, but these are the you know, it's just an open span. There's no W in the middle of it.
That would be a rafter.
Yeah, it looks kind of like a washboard. What can I do with that? I'm willing to even take the whole thing apart.
Well, so you are wanting to put a new roof on, is that correct? Are you having trouble with the roof?
Yes, I put a new roof on about 12, 13 years ago, and the shingles on it are already looking like they're 20 years old.
Okay.
About 50% of them are peeled up on the edges. There's a, you know, the roof is just wavy.
Right. Well, you know, that is a time period when we were seeing a lot of failure in roofing products, and so if it's been 12 years, you might not be able to obtain any sort of a warranty payout from the manufacturer, but I would encourage you to look into it, because there was a period right around, well, it was mostly in the early 2000s, right around 2000 to 2005, where manufacturers were playing around with the formulas of fiberglass shingles, and they really made some big mistakes, and there have been a lot of early shingle failures, and they have been making good on their warranties and giving people at least replacement product. And so I would encourage you to look into that. The other thing I would say is that the long-term, you know, if there aren't any structural problems with the roof, if it would appear that structurally those 2x4 rafters are holding up and everything is sound, it's not distorted or starting to, you know, show signs that it is, you know, changing in its basic shape, the building, that is, and the roof structure, then if you put a new roof on it, it's important that that be a well-ventilated roof, because that's going to, and that's just the space directly under the roof deck, that air be able to move from the bottom part, the eave, up to the top. And there are different strategies for that depending on how the farmhouse is built.
Right.
But that's what I would recommend, is good ventilation combined with a, you know, properly installed new roof. And of course, you know, you would tear off the old roof entirely, the shingles, and then you would install a proper underlayment, and then the new shingles.
Yeah, what I had done back in the day, it had four layers on it, going back to the original, I'm assuming the original cedar shingles, but pulled all that off, including the 1x4s that were used as the roofing
base. Right.
And then they, the guys put on half-inch OSB and then re-shingled it. And here we are just, you know, like, say, 12, 13 years later, and it's looking pretty shabby.
Yeah. I suspect it's the brand of the shingle that was used, and I think you might find, if you can find the paperwork or figure out who the manufacturer is, I would encourage you to do a little research, or if the company that installed the roof is still in business, you might contact them. I know roofing companies in Madison have been very responsive to customers to deal with these problems. So.
Yeah, good luck. Thanks very much for calling, Jeff. Appreciate your call. We have John in St. Paul, Minnesota, up next. Hi, John.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I'm following up with the radon testing question and information, but what if you have high ratings with the radon testing, what actions, what can I do to remediate that situation, and is it effective, and what's the general cost of something like that?
Yeah, you were able to do some of that to remediate for your own house, weren't you, John?
That's right, and radon comes from the ground, so we've got to seal up any of the cracks, seams, and holes that are in our concrete slab in our basement and our foundation wall as it leaks up from the ground to the footing into the foundation wall. If we have, for example, if we have a shower or a bathroom in the basement, there's going to be plumbing penetrations that go through the concrete slab that could be wide open to the ground. If we maybe there's an access cover or wherever the drain enters the ground, those types of locations have to be sealed up to prevent the radon from coming in our house. So that's the first step is in remediation is the air sealing and then retesting. If we just can't eliminate it through the air sealing, then it is installing a system. Essentially, we're going to pull air from underneath that slab and try to grab that radon before it enters our house and with a fan push it up and out the roof. We have to run a PVC system. Either we pull it, drill a hole in our concrete slab, maybe there's multiple locations, and we have a fan that will go either from the interior inside our house all the way out the roof, but oftentimes you will see them out on the exterior. Official strategies really is not to exit right out the rim joist or at the foundation and terminate it right there. We want to go above the roof so none of that has a chance to enter back into the home.
Yeah, and I can speak to that a little bit, Larry, because I had radon, high levels of radon in my own home. They were up around 18, and air sealing was not enough to bring that down. So we did put in a remediation system, as we've done for many clients, and it keeps it down around 3.
Okay.
It's
quite a difference.
Yeah, and the caller did ask about cost, and depending on what you have, a radon remediation system can run anywhere from $800 if you already have a sump pit in your basement. If you have an older home that doesn't have a sump pit or anything like that, you could spend upwards of $2,000, just depending. So the range is pretty broad, and there are a number of professional contractors that are willing to come and look and give you quotes on that.
Thanks a lot, John, for calling. Appreciate it. Chad Spade of Chad's Carpentry in Madison, John Viner of the Energy Center of Wisconsin, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Net. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Chad Spade and John Viner. And when you call in, our great producer, Judith Sears Poisson, answers the phone and moves you into queue to get to us. That's how we do it. She'll be with me tomorrow. As a matter of fact, we're jumping in the car this afternoon and we're heading for Bayfield, Wisconsin. Tomorrow we'll be broadcasting live from Bayfield in Bloom. I'll be at the Bayfield Pavilion there from, I'll probably get there around 10 o'clock, at least by 10 in the morning. And there are a lot of things going on at that Bayfield, in the pavilion at Bayfield tomorrow morning. So I hope you'll come by. If you're in the area, please come on over. Say hi. There's a big, the gang will all be there. That's for sure. Lots of WPR people will be there and lots of WPR listeners I know are going to be there, and there's always booths and some exhibits and a chance to buy some plants. Really a fun time. So that's tomorrow, and we'll be Judith's. I'm the co-pilot. Judith's the pilot this afternoon. She's driving her new car, and we're going to see if it actually run 500 miles or 300 miles. She says, "Of course it will." We'll find out. Rich in East Troy has a question. He wants to find something out, too. Let's go there. Hi, Rich.
Yeah, howdy. I'd kind of like to make a comment on that 4.0 percocuries for the radon.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, the EPA is going to drop that to 2.5 within a year or so. So if you're starting to get readings at over 2.5, it's not going to pass, and they're going to recommend a mitigation system.
Yep, no, that's good insight. I had heard rumors of that as well, and I think actually there's probably European countries that already have that lower threshold. So thanks for bringing that up, because it likely will, could certainly go that direction.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of surprised that installing the mitigation system brought it down to only 3.0. I do sampling that before and after the systems are installed, and boy, if I see a reading over 2.0 with a system installed correctly, it's really surprised me.
Yeah.
Well, I have a 1928 home. I don't know. I'm sure that maybe we would find some gaping hole somewhere, but we've done some pretty thorough testing, and I think it's just a matter of a lot of it's just an old big basement. So
yeah. And what a lot of times I do also is I'll test not only the basement, but I'll test the first floor living quarters, like in the bedroom, And it'd be surprising how often I get higher readings on that first floor than I do the basement.
Oh, that's an interesting statistic. I might try that myself. I like experimenting there a little bit.
Absolutely. That's why I do it.
Yep. Yep.
Thanks, Rich. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Tom in Green Bay has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Tom, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Actually, I got a couple questions. I have a block basement in very sandy soil. I don't have a problem with moisture, but I want to finish it off. Some of the rooms are studded, but I don't know, the spray foam or use bats, put poly in between there, the let it breathe, not let it breathe. You guys are talking about the radon there. I don't have a sump pump. We put this in just a few years ago, but it's so sandy there's never been a water issue through the walls. And also up in my sill boxes above that, I was doing some wiring in the wintertime, and I pulled insulation down to get at it, and it's wet behind there and some places moldy. No vapor barrier on it. Maybe that's what I need to do is somehow get that tucked in there, but looking for guidance.
Yeah. Okay, well, we can give you some guidance. So, you know, what is going on in the home is with that foundation wall, moisture drives to the inside most of the year. So we generally do not recommend putting in any sort of a vapor barrier. If you did put in a vapor barrier, it should be directly on the block wall. But really, the best place to keep the vapor out is on the exterior, because it's wanting to drive through that wall into the house. And so, you know, waterproofing the exterior would be the best choice, either doing nothing on the interior or doing something that's a vapor retarder right up against the foundation wall would be the only option there. And then a great product that we use is a spray foam, a two-part urethane foam that does actually create a vapor barrier. And it gives you a very good air seal and R value up against that foundation wall. And that is continuous, directly applied to the wall, you know, on the wall side of your framing. So we leave some space, generally an inch and a half of space, so that that foam is continuous behind the framing. And then you can have a framed wall and you can finish it out.
Yeah, and then I guess I would add a little bit, when you pulled that fiberglass insulation out of the rim joist and saw that it was wet and moldy, that's it's a relatively common phenomenon that the moisture from the inside in this case, not driven from the exterior as Chad is trying to manage the rainwater and the damp soils, but the interior humidity obviously flows right through that fiberglass insulation and condenses on that cold rim joist. And putting plastic or a polyethylene vapor barrier in that box sill can make the matters worse. And the reason being is that it's hard to get that flexible, thin sheet of plastic put up there airtight, where we're not getting any interior moisture behind there. And it can actually just trap moisture. So the spray foam, if we're going to finish that interior space out, as Chad said, on the concrete block wall, and then you can carry that foam to cover if it's a hollow block foundation wall. Then you want to cover the hollow block opening at the top and then carry it over the sill and up the rim joist and make it a very monolithic system, either with a spray foam or with a rigid foam board.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. That's the only problem I thought of up there in the sill. If I do spray, there's no way to check if it is molding behind there. No one's found it on. But in that two-part spray, you know, regular people can do that, or does that got to be farmed out through a contractor?
Right. It's generally installed professionally. It is possible to acquire the material at some of the home improvement stores, that they do tend to sell it just to a contractor. I wouldn't recommend a homeowner use it, but you know, I think it's worth hiring a professional for that particular thing, because then you can trust that you're getting the product. And most of the cost of that particular product is the product itself. The do-it-yourself kits often cost more for the product than a professionally installed application of the same product because they're able to use a more cost-effective means of delivering the material.
Oh, okay. So might even save money.
You would. You'll save money generally to have a professional install it. So
there you go, Tom. Thank you very much for your call. You can join in, too, by the way. I have some open lines to get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. And we did have a post on our web page, on the Facebook page, from Laura, who wonders what floor coverings you would recommend for a finished basement with radiant floor heating. The basement includes a bedroom, a three-quarter bath, and a large rec room.
Well, I would assume and hope that if it's a radiant floor, that it's a basement, that cement floor has been thermally isolated, so we're not heating.
You mean
heating.
Insulated?
Or, yes, insulated, yes. Thank you. So that is a nice, warm thermal mass in the home. And if that's the case, then materials such as tile are very good. I'm always nervous putting any sort of a wood material down over cement because, you know, if there's any moisture at all, which is going to find its way through that cement and out of it, I mean, again, the natural tendency down below grade is for moisture to drive from the exterior to the interior, and so moisture will drive through that floor into the basement, and if there's wood there, it'll drive into the wood. So you have to be very careful if you put down any sort of a wood product. But if you have properly installed when the basement was built, if there's a vapor barrier beneath that slab, and you can test for this, you can have a test done to see if there is vapor rising through that slab. If there is not, then you might consider putting down a wood floor. And that's a very nice, resilient surface.
Margaret in Chippewa Falls, it's your turn. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just wondering, we have just a crawl space in our basement, and we did have a radon remediation thing put in. They used the spray foam on the sill and the walls, and then put the tubing underneath on the ground and then put black plastic all over the top. And then it's vented out through the side and not real far. So we have like rain gutter extensions to get it out away from the house. But my question is, what's the best way to check to make sure that it's doing the job it's supposed to?
So we have the radon's mitigation system itself probably will have some sort of pressure gauge on it to know that it's creating a suction. Often it's a U-shaped tube with a red fluid in it. Are you able to monitor that?
I don't go down there.
Okay.
I can ask my husband too.
So that's one way to understand if there's a pressure or negative pressure being created in this case in your crawl space with the black plastic. And ideally it's probably good you don't crawl into that crawl space. We don't want that plastic disturbed. All the edges need to be sealed, and it really needs to be meticulous, and certainly have seen lots of systems that way, and often the plastic is crumbled up or ripped or torn or come apart. A few are certainly intact, but it's because no one goes into that area and somebody did a very good job. So making sure the integrity of that black plastic in that area is maintained is really important. But retesting, you know, call or go online to the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, find your radon information center located in your county, and talk to them about ordering a test kit. It is inexpensive. They do their best to really make it convenient to have that test, and that's the best place to know. And even when it comes related to radon and basement remodeling projects or even building a new house, there's a lot of preparation. You can take steps during the construction phase to build in that radon system if there's a concern or happens to be radon down the road. So those types of strategies are important to consider in any new construction or retrofit.
Mm-hmm.
Also, when it gets really humid, we get a odor in the house, and we assumed it was coming from our chimney and the fireplace. But we've had the fireplace pulled out and the chimney cleaned, and it all looks good. Could that be that the fan is pulling too much air?
Not if it's installed properly. So if you're getting, you must be getting smoke odors or soot odors within the home to contribute to the fireplace, but the radon should not be pulling from the home. Ideally, we don't want that to take place. So the volume of that fan that it's moving shouldn't depressurize or create any type of backdrafting down the chimney if it's operating and installed correctly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they put a rheostat on it so we could turn it down.
Okay. And
thinking that could be what was could be the problem.
Well, and then monitoring your radon levels is important as you make that adjustment. So maybe there's inaccuracies in each of these tests, but maybe a monitor that gives you a continuous readout might be interesting just to obtain and watch those levels, because you're tweaking one thing that'll affect another, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Good luck. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Appreciate the call. Pat in Eau Claire, it is your turn. Hi, Pat.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking the call. My son has a house here in Eau Claire that's built back in the 1870s, about a 2.5-story type house, and it's got the knee wall on the second floor, so it comes up about 3.5 feet, and then it's, the roof slope comes into the room. That was dense-packed when they insulated the house, so there's no airflow coming through the eaves as far as to cool the roof down, because that cavity is filled with insulation. We're looking at redoing the roof on the house. There's at least 3 levels of shingles, asphalt, plus the wood shakes underneath it yet. And the existing ones are, of course, curling like all the other ones do. We've had a few different people look at it and talk about putting a metal roof over top of what's already there to create a venting system. But what am I doing for weight on that roof? Are we starting to get awfully heavy?
Yeah, you're going to want to, I mean, you really should never have more than 2 layers of roofing on a house, and 3 is the absolute limit. So it's time, I think, to pull all of that roofing material off and start over. So I would definitely recommend that. If you do go to a metal roof, I mean, then a proper underlayment will be installed, and then the metal. And, it is true that additional ventilation would not be required. It's also true that a properly dense packed roof can perform very well, lacking that ventilation that we would typically like to see. A lot of times with construction like the house that you're describing, it's really a trade-off between whether or not we're going to have a well-insulated and more comfortable home or whether we're going to provide that ventilation to the roof. It's hard to do both depending on how the house is built. So, you know, if you're not having problems with ice damming in the wintertime, which is an indication that the dense packing maybe was not quite done or detailed sufficiently to prevent the heat from escaping, then I would be concerned that maybe that wasn't done meticulously enough to allow both the, you know, ice dams not to occur and for the roof to hold up. I think the curling is more likely to happen when you have so many layers, because you basically have a very uneven bed or underlayment on which that top roof layer is currently sitting.
Mm-hmm.
With the new metal roofs, they indicated that they had some type of a venting system that they actually put together when they put the, it was a metal shingle, not the standing seam type, and they said that would create an air vent capacity to cool that roof as well. Does that sound normal?
Yeah, I mean, there is a fair amount of airspace under those that shingle system that is kind of a, you know, it's a, there are various looks. It'll look like it's asphalt or clay tiles or whatever style you pick, but it's a metal, extruded product, and air will flow through that
Yes, Chad related back to the any types of symptoms or problems you're having to make a change, right, such as ice damming or ways, reasons why it's just not working as is. Going to a metal roof, obviously, we get that longer-lasting roof and higher quality and a ventilation system. You're not going to go wrong with that system. And probably Chad is saying still to remove the old roof material beforehand, and you wouldn't be making a mistake by doing that for sure, but I would look closely on whether how well it's performing now, if there's any symptoms of things that aren't quite working right in consideration.
Okay. It, the last thing I would add is it is possible to add a new ventilation system on top of that dense packed structure. That can be done. There are different strategies. We've done it for homeowners, and you can have it all, but, you know, there's expense involved in things like that. So,
yeah, something to think about. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. John Viner of the Energy Center of Wisconsin, Chad Spade of Chad's Carpentry in Madison, our guests. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at home repair and air quality, radon testing, all kinds of things with our two guests, John Viner and Chad Spade. Thank you for listening in. Please join in if you have a question about your home, something that's troubling you, something you may want to work on. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a question or a comment there. And Nick in Milwaukee is up next, so let's go there. Hi, Nick.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Hey, I've got a house in Milwaukee. It's built in 1941, and on the second floor is the bathroom in the house. And in the shower, about, 6 foot, 6.5 feet high, you know, right about head height, there's a vent. And I'm kind of concerned with, you know, water, you know, getting in it, or, you know, I don't know, could I just cover it up, or... It, you know, leave it on.
Is it a wall vent, an exhaust vent that sucks air out of the room through an exterior wall, or is it actually a part of the heating and cooling system?
I believe it's part of the heating and cooling system. It blows heat and okay. Cool air in the... So
that's a strange place for it, that's
so
for sure.
Yeah. So it's on an interior wall. It's just a heat vent on an interior wall, and you're thinking...
In the shower.
It's on the exterior wall.
Oh, it's on the exterior wall. Okay.
Yeah. And what are the... Are you having problems now with it, or just concerns that it's obviously inefficient on that exterior wall, but you're concerned maybe moisture from the bathroom is getting in there and creating some wet problems inside that wall cavity, which certainly could be the case, but that that house air or the humid air, if the heating system isn't on and the bathroom's full of moisture and it goes into that duct system, and it certainly could start dripping inside that ductwork. Ideally, there is ductwork there, and they're not using simply the building cavity itself as mm-hmm. a means. So we want to seal that up. Even I'm going to make the assumption that it's a metal ducting and it makes a turn and right at the wall, and you take the grill off and you'll see the metal ductwork. But
right,
around the edges between that the sheetrock or plaster and the metal ductwork, we just don't want an opportunity. Certainly, we don't want the moisture in the bathroom to find a pathway around that duct to get to that exterior sheathing.
Sure,
that wouldn't be good. But if you're going to remodel the bathroom, and are you thinking of a bigger project there, or just concerned about that one duct?
I'm just concerned about that one duct. I mean, I don't know if it would be, you know, if you could just like take a, I don't know if there's some sort of a blank, you know, you could just put over and take the grate out and put something that would just, you know, over it, or, you know, maybe just caulk around it so it doesn't get behind, you know, any water, or just and kind of eliminate it.
Yeah, what kind of exterior siding do you have?
It's brick.
Brick, so hard to take a look. If you wanted to look at the integrity of that wall cavity, one way to try to inspect it, trying to understand if there's a problem that we're solving here. Because you do want heat in the bathroom, so I don't necessarily recommend just blocking it off.
Okay.
And if at some point you really wanted to retrofit it and do it right, you'd pull that duct out of the exterior wall and maybe put a toe kick supply register in underneath the kitchen cat or the bathroom vanity there and remove it, eliminate it, and then insulate that wall cavity. Eventually, we'd want to get to that point.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there you go. Thanks.
Okay, so for now, just leave it as is, I guess.
Yeah, I would try to bend the metal of that ductwork a little bit to where at the wall and take a flashlight or try to probe some way that to know that there isn't a mold problem or a real serious problem with the integrity of the wall sheathing at that point.
There you go. Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. Reed in Clintonville, hi to you.
Yes. Hello, gents. Say, our son's home has recently developed a crack in the basement wall. It's a knee wall, and, of course, we can see right through to the outside, and maybe a half an inch wide or so. There's an operation that advertises on TV about repairing basement walls, but actually what I would just like you to do is maybe just speak to some of the questions that we should ask when we bring some, perhaps some concrete contractors in or whomever to give us an estimate and an evaluation.
Sure. How old is the home, Reed?
The home, I think, was built in sometime around the 60s, I believe.
Okay. And has the crack,
early 60s, I believe.
Has the crack been changing? Have you been
observing? No, I haven't seen any changes.
Okay.
You know, it's a like a tri-level. There's the basement and then a first floor and then a second floor.
Okay. Yeah, so, I mean, the thing that we're often most concerned about, if it's a particularly new home, or which it is not, or if it's a crack that you're seeing movement, you know, we're going to want to deal with reinforcing the footings of the home and trying to, you know, prevent this settling from continuing. It sounds like, you know, it is obviously some settling has occurred, and I think now you would just focus on using the appropriate materials to seal up that crack. Is it a poured foundation wall?
Yes, it's a poured wall.
Okay.
The crack has not really moved at all, and I think, as you said, you know, the footing probably shifted or moved just a little, settled a little bit, and then that developed, and there's no change.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any recommendations for a contractor? And I guess the things to ask is, what kind of materials would they use to fill that, Chad? Do you know?
Yeah, well, there are hydraulic cements, which are used typically that have a water-resistant quality and can, you know, will resist the water from driving through. Again, it's always best to repair a foundation from the exterior side when
right.
possible. If some waterproofing can be done on the outside, that is most desirable. But then some things will be done on the inside as well that are both cosmetic and the you know, patch of last resort to keep water and other things from coming in.
Well, thanks, gents.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking about settling, I was reading somewhere, and it could be apocryphal, but probably is, but there was a library that is sinking a little bit, and the comment was that the architects had not thought of accounting for the weight of the books that would be put in the library, so that apparently there'd be a lot of weight in books.
Right.
If you've ever had to move, we just, you know, moved a year or so ago, and the weight of those, you know, just the books in our little library was a lot. So,
well, if the architect's lucky, they can transition to digital books quickly, and maybe he'll be off the hook. So.
There you go. Yeah. Bill in New Lisbon, it is your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Going up to build a shed at our cabin, and the squirrels have been a constant problem. And I want to put a metal roof on, but with the, you know, the ridges in the metal roof, how do I seal that up to make sure the squirrels don't get up underneath that roof and start chewing on the new wood and making their way inside the shed? And then second question is, do you put much stock in the duct cleaning services I see advertised?
Well, Chad, I'll let you maybe take on the squirrels.
Yeah, well, I, you know, a properly installed metal roof is standing seam roof. I mean, there's not, if you put a drip cap on the perimeter of the wood structure and then install over that the metal roof, it's really all metal. So I would not see much of an opportunity for a industrious critter to get into that. So
I wouldn't be too worried about it.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about it. And then
the duct cleaning.
Yeah, duct cleaning. Certainly, if you know that the house has had, let's say a remodeling event where inadvertently a lot of particulate matter was sucked into the duct system or something like that, or you just know that the ducts are dirty, there might be some value in having the ducts cleaned out. But I think that that is a very rare need, and I think most homes probably don't typically need to have it done ever.
I guess I would add it depends on the individual. If there's health concerns, and often some health concerns or allergies or just poor health, and you can tie it to the indoor air quality because you feel better when you go other places, for example. That's just a one good step to make sure we're doing everything we can within our living environment to make sure things are clean. But I don't necessarily recommend it as a matter of course, but it certainly has its place.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Joe in Washburn, your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I want to ask you guys, I imagine you're just sick of answering these questions about different roofing systems, but I have a home that has like a pretty high pitch on it, a 10-12 pitch, and so the roof is a real architectural component in my home. And over here in Washburn, we've got an excellent building material supplier here that just gives me tons of information. Right now, I have 3/4 to 1 1/4 rough sawn cedar shakes. They've been up there for well over 40 years, and I'm interested in taking those off because, you know, I've got pine trees around, and you just can't get up there and clean those shakes off. You can't get the pine needles off them, so I've got some deterioration. So I want to take those off, but I'm looking at some different types of, I guess you'd say, shingles or material that emulates like either slate or very rough sawn cedar shakes. I really don't care for the metal material that's out there. I don't like the way it looks over on the gable end. I like the way a wood shake hangs over the gable end just slightly. What do you guys think? Do you have any advice? There's all kinds of eco stuff out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are some products that have been coming out in the last few years which are made out of recycled tires.
Yeah.
And I think that's a promising potential reuse of a waste product and turning it into something very useful on a roof. But I don't, there's, you know, it just hasn't been around long enough for me to be able to comment on the longevity of that product. And I am always a little nervous when something like that comes out, because we have certainly seen some of the newer products fail on the market. So, but there are some of those things out there. There are also PVC products, which I generally shy away from just because of how polluting it is to produce those products. But some of them are partially, if not almost entirely, recycled content. So that's another option. I don't know of anything else that I might recommend.
Okay, there we go.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I also did look at the option, you know, with the recycled tires, and you know, of course, I'm thinking about, will my yard start smelling like a
right,
like a tire landfill, you know, out there that we used to have years ago, you know?
Sure.
And they start gassing out, you know, but
yeah, it's possible.
But I've seen them, and they're very interesting. Although the bottom of that product, when you cut that at an angle, like for a fly rafter type of roof, when you cut it at an angle, it does not look, you know, on the back side like a cedar shake does. You know, it's a formed material.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, okay. Thank you. Thanks for trying to help me.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Paul in Racine, hi.
Hi, gentlemen. Thanks for your time today.
Sure.
Talking about remediation, I had a system put in that didn't work very well. The business that put it in failed over this last business cycle. The problem that we've determined is that the unit isn't sucking enough out from underneath the concrete. And I'm wondering, is there anything that you're aware of that I might be able to take and horizontal bore underneath the cement to make a small channel underneath the cement to try and get the system?
So you're thinking it's not maybe grabbing well, maybe because of the soil type underneath that slab, it's not pulling from a too large of a space.
That's correct.
And, yeah, so I think at times they, so have you, sometimes they'll take an experimental hole, quarter-inch concrete drill bit, and drill it in different corners or different areas within the basement and use a smoke pencil to see whether that one fan is actually drawing.
Yes, we did that in several places, and it's not drawing. I had somebody else that's got some construction experience take a look at it, and they said, yeah, this is not, not working. That's why you still have a high radon count.
And, you know, we're going to ponder that. We're going to think about that for a couple of minutes, take a look at the news, and then we'll be back, and we'll try and get an answer for you, Paul. Thanks for listening. Chad Spade, John Viner with us up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at home renovation and repair, radon issues, and air quality testing with our two guests, Chad Spade of Chad's Carpentry in Madison, John Viner, Senior Project Manager at the Energy Center of Wisconsin. Lots of callers online, and we've got email questions coming in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. And we have Paul online from Racine. Paul had a radon system installed. The system, and since the contractor is probably, it sounds like, gone out of business, and the system is not working. It's not, the fans don't seem to be doing anything. John Viner, what does Paul do?
That's a tough one. I think that I don't know of anything to drill horizontally or anything that's going to make, going to reach underneath that slab like we would want it to. If it's clay or it's packed underneath there, I think we're simply stuck with having to put multiple holes in that slab to try to draw for more reaches within that basement or underneath that slab. And whether it's multiple fans or whether you're tying those systems, that hole with PVC pipe together with one larger fan or multiple fans, I'm not an expert radon mitigation, so there might be a solution out there. Maybe somebody can help us. And Chad, you've got
an
idea?
Well, the one thing that you could do that we often do to take care of two problems at once would be to put in a drain tile on the perimeter of the basement, which is going to give you a connection to the soil under the slab on the entire perimeter wherever that is installed. It could be the entire house, or it could be two walls or one wall or whatever you choose to do. You can get pricing for different options. But if you do the entire perimeter and then have a sump pit with a pump, you will manage moisture, bulk water. You will keep the radon collection area drier, and you will allow the radon to connect to that sump. But of course, this is a much more expensive approach that's really primarily designed to deal with water from the outside, but it will allow that radon system to have some really good soil contact. So that's another possible way to do it.
There you go. Thanks very much for calling. An interesting Facebook photo, and I hope, oh boy, go to my Facebook page if you have the chance. At the Larry Mueller Show, there's a photo there that of a floor that's being done with pennies. And Kat just Facebooked us and says, thanks for these shows. I've learned a lot over the years, at least enough to ask informed questions when I need repairs or to talk to contractors. My question here is the penny tile project possible? a good or a bad idea? How would you prepare the surface, small linoleum in the entryway? What would I use to adhere the pennies, and what would I use to fill and level and coat the surface?
Larry, you always pick the hard ones for us.
I'm telling you, it really looks pretty nice.
You know, the thing that fascinates me about that is I know it cost about 2.5 cents to make a penny. So this is one of the few projects where you can acquire the material well below cost.
Well, and you're going to have 144 cents per square foot.
That's right.
That's what you're going to have. You're going to have $1.44 per square foot.
Yeah, plus whatever polymers are used to put it down. I'm reminded, you know, there are a number of bars in the Madison area that have coins adhered to the surface of the bar. I'm thinking of the glass nickel pizza establishment on Atwood, which has a lot of coins that are urethaned into that bar top, and it's a really cool looking bar. And so I don't know whether something like that would work on a floor. I would be a little worried about how slick it would be. You know, it would be a slippery surface, I would think. But
it sure looks nice.
Yeah.
Looks like they're using a sort of a combination of old and new pennies there and a little design work. I like it, Kat. You try it out and let me know how it works. Thanks a lot. You could adhere it. I mean, yeah. I don't know why you wouldn't be able to do that. Whoops. We have Teresa and Heartland up next. Hi, Teresa.
I've been having a continuous problem. Our house is about 7 years old, and our builder put the hot water heater. He put two 50-gallon tanks in the far corner. We have a pretty long ranch home, and he figured that we needed two of them because of the whirlpool tub, and then he put it in the one far corner, because I thought usually you put your hot water tanks more towards the center of the house so that you don't have as much water pumped to each sink and faucet. And so when we turn our water on, it comes up from the basement, being a ranch. It takes me to even do dishes in the sink about a 5-quart pail of water before it even gets warm. And then most of the time doing the dishes, it isn't even going to get hot, very hot. And then my daughter washed clothes, and the laundry room was in the room, just the room next over. And that water is, you know, heat at first. And she did a load of clothes, and she had very hot water, more than we ever get when we do dishes without running the wash machine. And then even the showers, it takes a lot of water before the water even gets hot. Mm-hmm. And I had been reading and heard about this continuous water system, or these
tankless
water heaters. Are they worthwhile to put in? Or should I put one like the ones that are under the one sink or something?
Well, even if you do put it in the location like the bathroom or the kitchen, then that's certainly going to save hot water. But if you put it where the other water heaters are, we still lose water down the drain. So it's not going to necessarily save on that efficiency, because we still got to get the water from point A to point B. And unfortunately, it's on one side of the house, and where you need it is on the other. So we'd like to have the water heater certainly closer to where we're going to use it. It does make sense, but sometimes it's by design, or there's certain reasons why.
Well, he did it because he figured it was going to fill up the mm-hmm. whirlpool tub first.
Right.
But we don't even use it anymore.
What kind of energy source do you have? Is it electricity or gas?
It's a gas hot water tank.
Gas hot water tank. So probably the first option is to, I think in your case, it would really save a lot of water, which is important. Is a recirculation pump at your fixtures. So, and maybe a plumber can design in one to handle a couple of fixtures depending on its location. But I guess a resource that I've gone to is a website is called, I think it's gothotwater.com. But you want to look up recirculation pumps for, you know, residential plumbing systems. And it is a pump that's installed under the sink or close to where the fixture is, and it actually pumps water. It connects to your hot and cold line, and it draws hot water from your hot water heater and then pumps it into the cold water line until you need it and open up the tap. So it could even be manually operated. When you walk into the bathroom or going to do dishes, you hit a button, it turns the pump on, and then within a couple seconds you turn the tap on and there's hot water without any waste. So it's a very effective way to minimize that water down the drain.
Mm-hmm.
Circulation.
Yep, water circulation pump. Gothotwater.com, I believe. They have a nice schematic and information on how something like that might work.
And I just wanted to comment. Of course, that does make it more convenient, and then you're not waiting or you're not wasting hot water. But I had a client recently bring up the issue of, well, what is the cost of operating that pump relative to the cost of maybe the wasted water that's going down the drain? And I think that's an interesting question because, you know, that is another thing to consider looking at the whole picture. Some of those recirculation systems, you know, allow you not to waste water, but you're still waiting for the hot water,
yeah,
and you're paying to pump the water. So, yeah. I mean, there are a number of issues to think about here, not to throw cold water on John's
John's hot water.
The power of the pump is it's pretty small, so I think the comfort that you gain is really important there.
Okay.
All right. Well, it's weird. We were just talking about this in our own home yesterday. My wife saying, "Why is it that in our bathroom, off our bedroom, you turn on the shower or turn on the tub water and it's hot almost instantly?" And 4 feet away in the same bathroom, you turn on the hot water for the sink, and you and either one of the sinks, and you wait quite a long period of time. And it's my mind's exploding trying to figure out why the heck that would be the case.
Huh.
I thought maybe the line is bigger for the tub, so the water comes up.
It must take a longer path to get there, so they didn't take the most direct route for one way or one.
But I mean, they're so close to each other; it's hard to imagine.
And it's the shower that has almost immediate.
The shower is almost immediate. Yeah,
I would imagine you use that when you haven't used the sink, right?
Right.
I
mean, yeah.
Well, yeah. So there's not a logical explanation that you use the sink to bring the hot water to the bathroom.
No.
I don't know. That's.
There's an art to that plumbing.
It's a mystery to me, I can tell you that. Becky in Eau Claire, thank you for calling. Hello. Shelly and Bloomer, let's go to you. Hi, Shelly.
It's Sheila.
Sheila? Oh, sorry.
We have concrete slabs for the apron of the garage and a sidewalk. And over the 16 years, they have sunken in spots. And I had a gentleman come out and talk about mud jacking, and then another gentleman talk about replacing them and then putting rebar, connecting it, my understanding, to the foundation of the garage. And I'm wondering if either one of those ideas are good, or is there another option I may have to raise the concrete away from the garage and out away into the yard and driveway.
Those are the two most common ways to accomplish the goal. But I do want to ask a question: do you have, if once this is raised, will there be a good pitch away from the garage out into the driveway, or do you have a gradient issue?
There should be enough, drainage away once they're raised.
And I ask that question because if you had those concerns, then that would argue for tearing out what's there and fixing the grade problem along with pouring new cement. And then at that time, the doweling can be done, which would connect the new apron and driveway to your foundation wall at the right there at the house. That is what perhaps should have been done when the driveway was originally poured, but it wasn't, and thus the sinking has occurred. And we do see that a lot on homes because, you know, when a house is built or an addition is built, there's excavation around the foundation, and then that backfill is put in, and that tends to settle. And so that's why a lot of times a front stoop or a driveway will settle right there up against the house. And that doweling is a really important step to prevent that from happening. But once you have this settling, mud jacking is often a perfectly effective way to still use the existing slab with considerably less cost and certainly fewer resources being used. And then you can generally count on that to last a good while. The settling that explains the typical settling of a slab up against a house, you know, that doesn't tend to continue for many years beyond the initial settling.
So I would recommend mud jacking, and I
would imagine the bids you have obtained, the mud jacking is less expensive than tearing it out and doweling, or are they comparable?
It's probably I'm not going to say half of what replacement would be, but mm-hmm. Maybe $500 difference.
Okay.
My concern with mud jacking, I've heard that it might, you know, if there's something wrong with the fill in those spots, that would just start to sink also, you know, or not.
Well, that is possible. I mean, there's no way to absolutely know what's going on with the soil beneath that without tearing it up. But I would think generally the mud jacking is a reasonable approach.
And what about the, you know, where they drill holes into the current concrete and then they have to fill them? Mm-hmm. Is there likely that those over, you know, a short distance of time, just chip away or something?
I have not typically seen that. They generally hold up well. So.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
So that's what you'd... And if they were to tie... If we were to replace the concrete and they were to tie it into the garage foundation,
mm-hmm.
does that cause any problem with the foundation? Or
it,
not?
It should
really...
not. No, it's a perfectly acceptable thing to do.
Now, if we're looking at mud jacking, is there a certain kind of material we should be watching for or watching against, you know, as far as their mixture that they put in?
I really can't speak to that. I'm not sure exactly what they use, but...
I can't help you out on that one.
But thank you very much for calling, man. Appreciate the call. Take a look at our Facebook page again at the Larry Mueller Show. We've got another photo, and this photo shows, this is from Rich, where the fireplace chimney stack passes through the second floor of their house into the attic. The chimney block seems to be solid concrete brick. The hole was only covered with cardboard and not sealed. Is the truss too close to the brick? The truss is only 3/4 inch from the brick and other
things.
Right.
So, well, for basic fire code, wood is not to be within 2 inches of a masonry structure. But we see it all the time in older homes that wood is right up against the masonry. So what I would say is that if you want to make this code compliant, then just a simple piece of metal slipped in between the wood and the masonry will take care of that and will, you know, provide the fire break between the wood and that masonry should the masonry get too hot and start to become a threat for combustion.
Can they seal the hole with sheetrock right up to or up against the brick, or would... You need a flashing there, too.
Well, the sheetrock can go right up to the masonry, okay. But it is true that they're going to want to cover that and air seal it, you know, to caulk it and to seal it. And I would actually recommend, given the size of that opening, if that is actually up in the attic looking down, you know, I would put in an additional 2x, something to hold the drywall and or plywood or a piece of plywood could be installed first and then the drywall over it. But I mean, structurally, I would not want to just put a piece of drywall there because if someone were to step on it, they would fall down into that chase.
Yeah.
And that would be a hazard. So, but drywall is a material that can be used to effectively air seal that. But there are some details that need to be tended to there. I can see how all those cables are making their way through that opening. And, you know, everything there is going to have to be properly sealed for it to have the impact or the effect of preventing air from going through that chase and contributing to comfort and energy loss problems.
Yeah,
so if people want to take a look, it's a great photo because these are like ha-ha moments for energy auditors and people trying to solve ice dam problems, for example. Mm. These are, whether there's cardboard there, if it's done a fair job, there's still a lot of heat loss. But oftentimes the cardboard or whatever was in place, if anything, often there's just a fiberglass bat laid across there. And those are ice dam causers, discomfort, and high energy bills, you know, culprits right there.
Yeah, interesting picture for sure. David Marinette has a question. Let's go to Dave. Hi, Dave.
How you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I want to put some metal roof on metal roofing over my existing one, and I got a couple skylights. How far back would I have to keep that metal roof from the box? The skylights are square box, you know, so I get a decent water flow. And one other question, that guy that called before is looking for them cedar shakes or like that. There's an Ondura panel out there that you can make that looks like tile. You might want to look at that, too. Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right.
So I take it these are curb-style skylights that have been built into your existing roof, that the roof will be going up to the curb. Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay.
They're box frame.
Okay.
They're self-venting.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure, to be quite honest, because I'd have to see it. I mean, I'm not envisioning what exactly you have, but typically any roof system, you know, whether it's going up to a wall or going up to a chimney or a skylight, you know, sort of structure, there should be parts that can be purchased and properly installed to make sure that the water is staying out of the structure. And then what we typically want to do whenever you have anything that sticks up out of a roof and the roof pitch is going down to that, so if the roof pitch is coming down to a chimney or coming down to a skylight or anything like that, we're going to want to have a little diverter that essentially sheds the water to one or both sides of that obstruction so that water is not, you know, hitting the chimney or the skylight or whatever, and then being more of a threat for water and debris. So that's what I would recommend.
Okay.
All right. There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Chad and John, thank you so much.
Thanks,
Larry. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks,
the time flew by.
Yeah.
And we'll have these guys back in a couple months, and we'll do this all over again. Hey. And Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison. You can go online. You got a website there,
yep.
Chad's Carpentry.
That's
and John
correct.
And John Viner, the Energy Center of Wisconsin. And again, you have a site there as well for the
yep.
Energy Center.
ECW.org. A little bit of research, a lot of education opportunities. So.
Yeah. And I know Chad's got some cool shots of work that he's done on various homes. It's just kind of,
yep.
really kind of fun to look at. There's some. Quite a difference before and after. Oh, man. So we'll have them back and we'll do this again. Thank you so much for listening in. Don't forget, if you're in the Bayfield area tomorrow, please be sure to come to the Bayfield Pavilion. I'll shake your hand and we'll have a picture together and Judith will give you her autograph. and she'll say hi and it'll be a lot. It's going to be a lot of fun. That's from 11 to 12:30, but come early. Come at 10 o'clock or so, and we'll have some time to visit and chat. That's in Bayfield tomorrow at the Bayfield Pavilion to bring in Bayfield in Bloom. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.